Welcome to Knowing God in the Word, brought to you by the Word of Truth Ministry, publishers of Seed and Bread. I'm your host, Bob Juno, with Bible teacher Nathan Johnson. This radio program is for the purpose of helping listeners fulfill the greatest need we have as believers, to know God. Today, Nathan will continue his teaching series on the book of Judges with Wives for Benjamin. And now, Bible teacher Nathan Johnson.
Thanks, Bob. So in getting toward the end of the book of Judges, in chapter 21, the final chapter, we saw last time that Israel, after defeating the tribe of Benjamin, wiped them out in a systematic purge. But then afterwards, they regretted the loss of one tribe out of the nation of Israel. Only 600 Benjamite men had escaped, but all the Benjamite women were dead, wiped out by the army of Israel. Moreover, the army of Israel and their zeal against Benjamin for siding with the wicked city of Gibeah and those men who had done a terrible crime similar to that done in Sodom and Gomorrah in Genesis. Well, in their zeal, they had made an oath not to give any Benjamite a wife from their daughters. So they say, where in the world are we going to find women for Benjamin so that this tribe isn't wiped out from among Israel? Where are we going to get women from when we all swore an oath that we wouldn't provide wives for any Benjamite? And yet all their women are dead. Well, it seems that their minds turned to another oath they had made at the same time. And this was that they had made a great oath when they all gathered together after our hero, quote-unquote, the Levite man whose concubine had been killed, called them together. They made a great oath about any city that didn't come to the congregation, that that city would be put to death. And in Judges 21, verse 8, they said, "What one is there from the tribes of Israel who did not come up to Mizpah to the Lord?" And in fact, no one had come to the camp from Jabesh-Gilead to the assembly. Gilead, remember, was the land east of the Jordan River. Most of Israel was in the former land of Canaan, west of the Jordan, between the Jordan and the Mediterranean Sea. But Reuben, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh had taken their lands over on the east side of the Jordan, and that was often called Gilead. Now, it's a bit confusing as to what exactly was Gilead, because it's clear that sometimes Gilead is used just for all the land east of Jordan. It's just all called Gilead. In some places, it is said that Gilead is the southern part of that land east of the Jordan. So it's actually the land that Reuben and Gad took, whereas Manasseh took the land in the northern part of that part east of Jordan, which was called the land of Bashan. But Gilead was actually the name of a grandson of Manasseh. And there are places where you will read that Manasseh's children, the half-tribe of Manasseh that was east of the Jordan, took the land of Gilead and made it their own. So it seems that even that northern part that's sometimes called the land of Bashan could also be called Gilead. So when it says Jabesh and Gilead, we aren't sure where exactly it was, whether it was Manasseh or Reuben or Gad, but it was one of those three. Now this town Jabesh, in this case, turned out to be a cowardly town or a neglectful town. They didn't come to the assembly. But there are three Bible stories about Jabesh and Gilead. This is the first. The second is, at the beginning of the reign of Saul, Nahash of the Ammonites threatens to humiliate every inhabitant of Jabesh, and Saul comes and rescues them with the army of Israel. And in the third story, when Saul is killed by the Philistines in battle, the men of Jabesh come and valiantly rescue his body from where the Philistines had humiliated it and brought it back to Jabesh for an honorable burial. So this city, well, it starts out, the first story you have of it is bad, is really shameful. The final story, they end valiantly. Now, verse 9 says, "For when the people were counted, indeed, not one of the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead was there." Now, it was not necessary that every single Israelite come to this assembly. But every single town, every single city was expected to send representatives. And it was found when they looked into it that not a single one of the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead had come. Now think of this. If one man had come from Jabesh-Gilead to the assembly, that one man would have saved the city. And that's interesting because, of course, we know that Jesus Christ is the one man who saved us all. I wonder if there were other towns in Israel where only one person from the town had come and that person had saved that town. But not one in Jabesh-Gilead had done that. Verse 12, so the congregation sent out 12,000 of their most valiant men and commanded them, saying, go and strike the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead with the edge of the sword, including the women and the children. So the army of Israel doesn't bother all going to Jabesh themselves, because the town isn't that big, but they send out 12,000 of their most valiant men, sons of strength, it says in Hebrew. And they are to wipe out Jabesh and Gilead according to their oath, that they would put to death any city that didn't come. So this is the beginning of their solution to the fact that there are no wives for Benjamin, and that is more slaughter. Wonderful. I'm speaking a bit sarcastically there. And you might say, well, they had this oath, they had to fulfill it. Well, yes, but what a bloody oath to have taken in the first place. And we see Israel took several rash oaths, and their oath not to give a wife to Benjamin, they regretted. It's kind of like earlier we read the oath of Jephthah, this rash oath he took. It seems all Israel had taken this rash oath about Benjamin. But now they fulfill yet another oath by wiping out Jabesh-Gilead, but not all of them. Verse 11, and this is the thing that you shall do. You shall utterly destroy every male and every woman who has known a man intimately. So they are to destroy every male out of the city, young and old. And then every woman who has known a man intimately. They are to destroy all those out of Jabesh-Gilead systematically, just as they had wiped out Benjamin. Verse 12, so they found among the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead 400 young virgins who had not known a man intimately. And they brought them to the camp at Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan. So these 12,000 men of Israel do what the rest of the Israelites commanded them. And that is, they go to Jabesh, and they wipe out all the inhabitants, but they save the young virgins, the girls of Jabesh, alive for the Benjamite men. Now they find that the total number of girls in Jabesh is 400. Now, I would note here that probably many of these young virgin girls were not yet marriageable age. But it wasn't at all unusual for a girl to be betrothed long before she could marry. The fact is that any time a man, a father, a patriarch, thought he was going to die, he would do what they called putting his house in order, which involved arranging everything, arranging all the business deals, and preparing the family for his death. And one of the things he would need to do is to make sure that all his daughters were betrothed, had a future husband lined up. Now, even if the daughter was very young, long before marriageable age, say she was 5 years old, he would still want to put his house in order. He'd still want to betroth her to some man. Now, she couldn't marry him, or probably some boy, I should say. She couldn't marry him for maybe 10 years or so, but he would still want to have his house put in order. So to have a girl betrothed long before she could get married would not be uncommon. So they find these 400 girls and they bring them back to the camp at Shiloh. Now notice this, that it says they brought them to camp at Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan. Now this is very interesting because I would typically call it the land of Israel, not the land of Canaan. A lot of people today call the land of Israel Palestine, which really means land of the Philistines. Well, the Philistines are the Palestinians, not the Israelites. But calling it the land of Canaan, very interesting. Now, probably this was because the land of Gilead, where Jabesh was east of the Jordan and was not originally the land of Canaan that Israel was promised, whereas west of Jordan was the former land of Canaan. But also, I can't help but think about how much Canaanite-like activity had gone on throughout this whole story. From the very beginning, where a man had a concubine, a slave wife, to the people of Gibeah, from the very beginning, where the Levite had a concubine, a slave wife, to the Canaanite-like activity, sexual deviancy of the men of Gibeah, to just the heartless slaughter of Israel of the tribe of Benjamin, there was an awful lot of Canaanite-like activity going on here. And Israel had ultimately treated Benjamin and Jabesh like they were Canaanites, the ones the Lord had told them to wipe out. Now notice this, very interestingly, that they bring the girls back to their camp at Shiloh. And we saw it earlier that their camp was at Beth-El, the house of God. Well, perhaps their camp was actually, you know, it had to be kind of spread out. It wasn't just in one place. This was a large army, so maybe it sort of spread from Bethel to Shiloh, kind of all the country in between. But they bring these girls there. Verse 13, then the whole congregation sent word to the children of Benjamin, who were at the Rock of Rimmon, and announced peace to them. So they know about these Benjamites hiding out at the Rock Rimmon, so they send ambassadors to them to make peace with them. Tell them, we don't want to wipe you out anymore. Come back. Verse 14, so Benjamin came back at that time, and they gave them the women whom they had saved alive of the women of Jabesh-Gilead, and yet they had not found enough for them. So the Benjamites, when they hear Israel no longer wants to wipe them out, they return from the Rock Rimmon. And it seems that Israel greets them with something like, sorry, we killed all your women, but here are some we found for you. Very nice. But note, I don't know if Israel knew exactly how many Benjamites there were, but remember there were 600 Benjamite men, and there had only been 400 Jabeshite young women or girls. They hadn't found enough for the Benjamite men, and they found this out at this point. They're 200 short. Verse 15, and the people grieved for Benjamin, because the Lord had made a void in the tribes of Israel. So again, Israel grieves for Benjamin. They're sorry that Benjamin has had this happen to them, that this tribe is threatened to be wiped out. Notice it says, Yahweh had made a breach in the tribes of Israel. And they're sorry, and they want the breach mended. Well, it's true Yahweh had made a breach. Eventually, you know, it wasn't his breach at first. They had come to the Lord and said, hey, we have this plan. We're going to attack Benjamin. Here's your part of the plan, Lord. Who should go to attack him first? So they say Yahweh had made a breach. Well, perhaps behind the scenes, but their dealing with the breach had been all their plan. Their plan had been to attack Benjamin. Their plan had been to systematically wipe Benjamin out in a war of purging. This had all been their plan. It hadn't been Yahweh's plan. So Yahweh perhaps had made the breach, but how to deal with the breach, they had decided out of their own minds and hearts. Verse 16, then the elders of the congregation said, what shall we do for wives for those who remain, since the women of Benjamin have been destroyed? Well, they're still short 200 wives, and they're trying to think where they can come from. Notice they say, since the women of Benjamin have been destroyed. They don't say, since we destroyed the women of Benjamin. Notice how they separate themselves from what they did. Whose fault was it that the women of Benjamin had been destroyed? Did these young women, did these girls really deserve to be destroyed? Well, they don't question that. They just ask, where should we get women for Benjamin? Verse 17, and they said, there must be an inheritance for the survivors of Benjamin, that a tribe may not be destroyed from Israel. So the reason they feel bad is not so much that they feel bad about these Benjamites that they wiped out. They just want this tribe to survive because they said it wouldn't be fitting or proper for a tribe to be missing from Israel. Well, it's not very compassionate, but at least it's a good goal that a tribe not be wiped out. But why didn't they think of it before? Well, they were out purging the tribe of Benjamin from existence. Verse 18, however, we cannot give them wives from our daughters, for the children of Israel have sworn an oath saying, cursed be the one who gives a wife to Benjamin. So they're meeting, and they're thinking this through, and they're saying, well, we want them to have wives, but we made this great oath of a curse on anyone who would provide a wife for a Benjamite. So we can't give them wives from our daughters. We just can't do it. So they're trying to figure out, what can we do? Well, somebody has a brilliant idea. Verse 19, then they said, in fact, there is a yearly feast of the Lord in Shiloh, which is north of Bethel, on the east side of the highway that goes up from Bethel to Shechem and south of Labona. So they say, hey, there's this yearly feast of Jehovah, of Yahweh. Now notice they talk about this as if all didn't even know about this feast. Now it seems likely that the yearly feast they're talking about, and there were several yearly feasts, but it seems likely that the yearly one they're talking about is the great feast, the Feast of Passover. And remember that according to the law, every Israelite male was supposed to attend the Passover every year. And if he didn't, he was supposed to be cut off from Israel. Not only that, but though the penalty was less severe, there wasn't a penalty of being cut off from Israel. Every Israelite male was supposed to attend two other feasts at Jerusalem yearly as well. So every Israelite man should have come to the Feast of the Lord three times a year, which at this time was at Shiloh, later was at Jerusalem. They should have known the route to Shiloh by heart to the tabernacle and to attend the yearly feast. And yet the fact is that from the way they have to describe exactly where this is, it's fairly clear that there were a lot of men in Israel who had never attended Passover even once in their lives. So it's clear that faithfulness to God's law was not common, even here where some of the Israelites from the wilderness were still alive. So though their camp apparently was near Bethel and Shiloh, it wasn't right at the tabernacle. So they're having to describe exactly where this feast takes place. So this probably, again, is a solution to our mystery of the camp at Bethel or at Shiloh. That it's somewhere in between, but not right at the tabernacle. So they give directions to this feast, and they're probably giving them to the Benjamite men. So verse 20, therefore they instructed the children of Benjamin, saying, go lie in wait in the vineyards. So these are the children, really the sons of Benjamin. And I think there's no doubt about it, these are the 200 Benjamites who are still without a wife. So they tell them to go to the vineyards near Shiloh and basically set up an ambush. Verse 21, and watch. And just when the daughters of Shiloh come out to perform their dances, then come out from the vineyards, and every man catch a wife for himself from the daughters of Shiloh. Then go to the land of Benjamin. So they say, watch out, because at this feast, the daughters of Shiloh, the young unmarried women, are going to come out and dance. Then you come rushing out of the vineyard, catch a wife for yourself from the daughters of Shiloh, and go back to Benjamin with her. This reminds me of the old cliche or cartoon thing of the caveman who hits a woman over the head with a club and then drags her back by the hair to his cave to be his wife. So this is kind of the caveman method of getting a wife here, is to kidnap a girl. And she's going to be your wife because you grabbed her. Now notice this part about the young women of Shiloh coming out to dance at the feast. Now remember that part in God's law in the books of Moses where it describes how they're supposed to be dancing girls at God's feast? Remember that part? I hope you don't, because I don't either. There is no such part. Dancing girls at the Lord's feast? Especially if this is Passover. Passover is supposed to be about remembering the bitterness of their slavery in Egypt and being grateful to the Lord for delivering them from that slavery. There was no part of this feast that involved dancing girls. Now, a note in the Companion Bible says this was probably picked up from the Canaanites, and it probably was. But everybody likes dancing girls, right? So why not incorporate them into God's feast? Well, here again, we see an example of everyone doing what's right in their own eyes. This is what the priests at Shiloh are doing. This is what they're teaching their daughters to do at God's feasts, is to dance. Well, they're to kidnap these girls to be their wives and run with them back to Benjamin. So these would be Levite girls. Remember, the girls they got out of Gilead were probably either Manasseh, Reuben, or Gad. They say, well, those priests, they don't need their daughters. You might as well kidnap a priest's daughter for a wife. Very nice way to treat your priests. Verse 22, then it shall be, when their fathers or their brothers come to us to complain, that we will say to them, be kind to them for our sakes, because we did not take a wife for any of them in the war. For it is not as though you had given the women to them at this time, making yourselves guilty of your oath. So they say, if you do this, their fathers and brothers are probably going to come and complain. And notice this, fathers or brothers. If their father was still alive, he'd be the patriarch and in charge. But if he was dead, just like we saw back in the story of the Song of Solomon, if the father was dead, the young girls of the family would be under the charge of their brothers. So either the fathers or brothers are going to come and complain, and we'll tell them, hey, don't worry about it. We took this great oath we won't give any Benjamites wives, but you didn't give them to them and break the oath. They kidnapped them, so that makes it all okay. And we'll make it good for these fathers or brothers. We'll pay them a bride price or whatever they want. So that's what they tell the Benjamites. Verse 23, and the children of Benjamin did so. They took enough wives for their number from those who danced, whom they caught. Then they went and returned to their inheritance, and they rebuilt the cities and dwelt in them. I can't help but think about the difference between these two sets of women. The 400 had the women from Jabesh and Gilead, and the 200 had a woman from Shiloh. Remember, the 400, she has this woman, her family was wiped out by the army of Israel. But her husband, the Benjamite, his family had been wiped out by the army of Israel too. She would be in mourning for her family, but at least the man, who is now going to be her husband, could sympathize. He'd say, yes, I know what you're going through, dear. The same thing, my family was wiped out by the same people as yours was. And talk about starting out with a bond. But then compare that to these 200 girls. Well, my husband is the man who kidnapped me, who grabbed me and ran away with me and forced me to marry him. If I was going to be one of these two sets of Benjamites, I think I'd rather be the one with one of the 400 girls from Jabesh, not one of the ones with the 200 kidnapped girls from Shiloh. But I guess it worked out anyway, Benjamin continued. Verse 24, so the children of Israel departed from there at that time, every man to his tribe and family. They went out from there, every man to his inheritance. So with this all done, with the Benjamites having wives, Israel breaks camp and heads back home. Ah, they tell themselves, we did a good job, a job well done. What was their job well done? Well, they blew their stacks over an act of immorality. They went and attacked their brother tribe Benjamin. The Lord allowed them to get defeated twice, trying to point out their hypocrisy, and yet they refused to even think about it. He finally gave them the victory over Benjamin. What did they do? They systematically wiped Benjamin out. Then after doing it, they regretted it because the tribe was missing from Israel. Went and wiped out some other Israelites at Jabesh-Gilead to get wives for the Benjamites. Then had the Benjamites kidnap more women, and then went home. So murder, death, and kidnapping. That was what they had accomplished. Job well done for the Israelites. And it's all summed up in verse 25. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And this is exactly the state of Israel during this book, and especially during these last five chapters of this book. Now, every man doing what was right in his own eyes with no king, there was an upside to that, and that was everyone was more free. And individual towns and regions in Israel could choose to follow the Lord, could choose to do what was right, could choose their own path. But the downside versus having a righteous king is that many of them didn't follow a righteous path. They followed their wicked hearts into wickedness. So that's a downside versus having a righteous king. However, having freedom and follow the Lord, even if people around you are unrighteous, of course, is the advantage over not having a wicked king who might oppress you if you do that. All are free here to worship the Lord according to their consciences. But the problem is that their consciences were corrupt, and they worshiped other gods other than the Lord. And it's interesting to me to note that this book starts out with them failing to wipe out the Canaanites at the command of the Lord, but it ends up with them almost successfully wiping out the Benjamites out of their own minds and hearts, what they decided to do. Very interesting contrast that. They wouldn't obey the Lord's commands, but when it was their own plan to wipe out one of their brother tribes, they did it. Now, we can look down on them for all this, but we too, in fact, have great freedom in the dispensation of grace. And in many ways, we can do whatever is right in our own eyes. And oftentimes, I'm afraid, just like in these last five chapters of Judges, when we do what's right in our own eyes, things get messy. And we think what many Christians and what many churches do, we see how messy it gets when people just do what's right in their own eyes. So what will we do? Will we walk as if the Lord is our King? Will we subject our actions to the commands in God's Word? Or will we do what's right in our own eyes? What we need to do is to follow Ephesians 4:1. Therefore I, the prisoner of the Lord, beseech you to walk worthy of the calling with which you are called. We were called to follow Jesus Christ, and we're called to live lives worthy of that calling. And the question for us is, will we do it? So the solution the Israelites came up with for providing women for Benjamin was to wipe out some other Israelites and take their girls. When this wasn't enough, they had the Benjamites kidnap some of the priest's daughters to make up the difference. Everything in this last portion of Judges is just as Judges 21:25 says, all did what was right in their own eyes, and they didn't acknowledge the Lord as their king. Judges started with Israel failing to wipe out the wicked Canaanites, and ends up with them all but succeeding at wiping out their own brother tribe, Benjamin. We might criticize this, but do we do the same? Do we follow what God really says he wants, or do we do what seems good to us? This is the great lesson of this last section of Judges, that we should do what's right in the eyes of the Lord.
It's easy to condemn Israel for her failures. Time and again, we see them ignoring God's direction and doing what is right in their own eyes. Today, in the dispensation of grace, we too are allowed to do what is right in our own eyes. The only way our eyes can guide us along a proper path is when we set them on God's Word. Thank you, Nathan, for your lesson on Wives for Benjamin. On our next program, Nathan will continue his teaching series on the Book of Judges with Eli, the 13th judge. Thank you for joining us today. Our hope is that as you study God's Word more, you know and love God more. For more information on the program, to hear past programs, and for other downloadable material that Nathan has produced, please visit our website at knowinggodintheword.org. We also send out a weekly email newsletter in which Nathan does the same thing he does on this radio program, going verse by verse through the Bible and then discussing what it means. Email Nathan at nathan@knowinggodintheword.org and ask to be placed on this mailing list. You can also write to us with Bible questions or comments. For more Bible study literature by Nathan and other Bible teachers, including Seed and Bread Bible studies, please visit the Word of Truth Ministry at seedandbread.org or write to the Word of Truth Ministry, P.O. Box 1609, Canyon Country, California, 91386. Although your donations are always appreciated, you will not be solicited for funds in any way when you write, so feel free to contact us. I'm your host, Bob Juno, with Bible teacher Nathan Johnson. So long for now, but we look forward to you joining us next week on Knowing God in the Word.